Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Welcome to a very special episode of True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thank you for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me as always, at the controls, manning, steering the ship, the captain.
Thank you, thank you. It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you.
Thank you again for joining us in the garage for this very special episode. Let me get you guys a beer. Tonight we're drinking Gamma Bomb by Warped Wing Brewing Company. Garage grade, 4.5 out of 5 bottle caps. Gamma Bomb is a piney India pale ale exploding with hoppy goodness. This week's beer is brought to us by you. So thank you for joining us and cheers.
Yes, cheers. A big thank you to everybody for buying the episode. We work really hard to put out a free episode every week. And this goes a long way towards continuing to do so. So cheers to everybody. I like the cut of yo jib.
We got a jam-packed show tonight. So gather around, grab a chair, get comfortable. Here's your Gamma Bomb beer. Let's talk some true crime. This is True Crime Garage. And this is the case of Tony Muncy. Sunday, October 16th, 1983. The mutilated body of a boy is discovered. Men looking for deer spotted garbage bags near a wooded area on the side of a country road. One of the men told police, "I thought I saw an elbow sticking out of the bag, but it turned out to be a leg." Police said the boy's arms had been cut off at the shoulder, and his torso had been mutilated with a knife. His neck had been gashed deep, and the stomach cut open. Police are looking for a vicious killer, and neighborhood children and parents are terrified. The mother said, "Since the discovery of my son's body, I can't sleep. I have the same nightmare over and over. I'm standing in the family room, and I look up the stairs. I see my boy. He's alive. He's smiling at me, but he has no arms. there is a dark, shadowed man standing behind my boy. And when I squint to make out the face of the shadow man, I wake up. The body of John Anthony Muncy, who was known as Tony by his friends, was discovered at 8 a.m. on Sunday, October 16, 1983, stuffed in four plastic garbage bags along a rural stretch of South Galena Road in eastern Delaware County, Ohio. The body was discovered by Richard Pistell while he and a friend were driving to Pistell's home after grocery shopping. They were heading east on South Galena Road, and the two of them were looking for deer when they spotted garbage bags on the side. Pistell told the police and the Columbus Dispatch that he had thought that he saw an elbow sticking out of one of the bags, so when they stopped, they looked at the bags and it turned out to be a leg. When police arrived, what they would find is five trash bags, and in one of the trash bags were the boy's severed arms. That somebody had taken three trash bags and put them together, and inside those trash bags, there was the body of Tony Muncy rolled up in throw rugs. There was a fifth trash bag that was found near the body, and this was a bag that contained bloody clothes inside. Now, Tony was found naked inside the rugs. The clothing is believed to have been Tony's, and there was an extra shirt in there as well that they didn't know who the shirt had belonged to. This shirt was bloody as well.
Yeah, he could have been wearing two shirts at the time.
So the sheriff, William Laverly, said that the boy's arms had been cut off at the shoulder and that his torso had been mutilated with a knife or a sharp instrument. The neck had a big gash in it, a big deep gash in it, and the stomach had been cut open.
Yeah, maybe to drain the body.
Yeah, the garbage bags were found on the north side of the road between Alexander and Golf Course Roads, lying about 10 to 15 feet from the road.
Do you know what time they were found?
Yeah, at 8 a.m. on that Sunday.
So, can you imagine driving with your buddy to go hunting? And you just, because it wouldn't make any sense that you would just stop because you see garbage bags, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, they're driving along the road. They're returning from the grocery store. They just picked up a couple of items. And their intention was to go hunting within the next several days. Now, this area is very country. So, while they're driving home, they're looking to see if they see deer, because they want to see activity of deer so they know what spot to go to hunt.
Right.
And so, they're kind of combing the area as they're driving home, and they spot these trash bags. Now, I don't think that they typically would have stopped just because of the trash bags, but they stopped because they saw something sticking out of one of them.
Yeah, that looked human, I guess, would be the main thing. Human limb. I wonder if they were going grocery shopping for beer Sunday morning. Are they allowed to buy beer at Sunday morning?
Back then, I don't think so.
Okay.
Let's go through the bag that contained the clothing real quick. Inside the bag, they found blue jeans, a pullover shirt, a denim jacket, as well as bloody rags and towels that were found stuffed in the bag. Now, due to the lack of blood at the scene, it was obvious to authorities that Muncy had been killed elsewhere and then dumped in Delaware County.
Right, which would make sense with the cutting open of the stomach, maybe to drain out the body.
For the listeners that are not in Ohio, we have to describe these areas to people. So Anthony Tony Muncy lived in Franklin County. He lived on the east side of Columbus. In 1983, the population in Franklin County was approximately 888,000 people. Where his body was dumped was Delaware County, which is just northeast of Franklin County. The county lines touch one another. Delaware County's population in 1983 was just 57,000 people.
Yeah, it's a pretty podunk.
So what you have here is a situation where if you wanted to get a victim, do something to them, and get rid of them, well, you have a spot where it's easy to find victims because there's so many people populating Franklin County. You go down there, you pick somebody out, pick up a hitchhiker, or you pick up somebody at a store, however you meet this person.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if you already knew him. And then when you want to get rid of the body, you drive him up northeast, 20-minute drive.
Right.
And you pick a spot and you throw them out on the side of the road.
But fucking nowhere.
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, I've been to the spot where the trash bags were found.
Why don't you tell me about that?
Okay, so I went to this spot about 2 years ago, 2014, and I went on a Thursday or a Friday afternoon, approximately 2 or 3 in the afternoon.
You need more hobbies.
Yeah, so I went up there, and while I was there, I stopped and I was at the site walking around. I walked around for about 20 minutes. And during the course of that 20 minutes, one car had passed me. Now, so think about this. This was a weekday afternoon when you expect to see more traffic.
Yeah, people going home from work and stuff like that.
His body was dumped. We can only speculate, but it was dumped sometime either late Saturday night or early Sunday morning.
Right.
When you wouldn't see any traffic at all. And actually, one of the law enforcement officer, the deputy that was first on the scene, mm-hmm. told the newspapers, look around here. There's not a single house within a quarter of a mile in any direction of this spot.
Oh, which is pretty far.
Yeah. He said, it looks like somebody picked a really good spot to dump a body.
Yeah,
definitely. And it was obvious to the law enforcement at the time that whoever had dumped the body there had slammed on their brakes and decided they just happened upon that spot. I don't believe that somebody knew exactly where they were going to take that body and dispose of it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that somebody knew the area that they wanted to go to. But when they happened onto that spot, they slammed on their brakes. They found skid marks on the side of the road. Now, when you're heading north on that street, there's a curve.
Uh-huh.
And when to this day, when you go around that curve, everything disappears. You don't see anything but road and trees. Trees on each side of the road.
Right.
And then it curves. It continues on for a little bit and it curves again. So for like a little spot there, you're very secluded.
Yeah. I wonder too if it was coming just off of any major highway and then just that's how they got to that road.
Well, there are a lot of state routes near there.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have actually got to it from several state routes. I'm not certain of what you could have taken off of 71 north at the time.
Yeah, it just makes more sense to me that they'd be coming off of like a major highway and then they just get the side road. And then based on the side road, they're driving and all of a sudden they go, oh, here's a good spot right here. Not that it was like planned out way ahead of time, hence the skid marks of the car. You would think that they would know that they're coming to the spot that they planned if they planned that spot in the beginning.
Because this was a small town area, because this was a country, this was being investigated by the sheriff's department. So, smaller group of guys, smaller group of investigators, maybe less experienced in this type of thing. But they spent most of that Sunday, the day that the body was found, trying to identify that body. It was around 7 p.m. that evening that Gladys Muncy called the sheriff's department to tell them that her son John, better known as Tony, he had not come home Saturday night. Now, this didn't raise any alarms to them because she had assumed that he had decided to stay the night at a friend's house. This was a friend that lived in Tony's neighborhood.
Right, but he's only 15 years old, right?
He was only 15 years old, but let's talk about who Tony was real quick, okay? So, Tony was what you might refer to as a troubled youth. Now, he didn't really have anything that...
I mean, to be fair, we're all troubled youth.
I think everyone's troubled for some portion of their youth.
I'm still troubled youth, and I'm not that young.
So, the year before, Tony had a lot of missing absences, a lot of absences from school. He missed like weeks and weeks of school, where he was just ditching school and kind of going out and doing whatever he wanted. The parents got him enrolled in a school called Rosemont. Now, what Rosemont was, it was a school for troubled teens. Now, it had varying levels of troubled. And what that could mean is some of the students lived there full time. They would not only attend school there, but they would stay the night and they would stay the weekend. That was for the more troubled kids, let's say. Tony was a little bit less than that. He went to school there. And he would return home and stay the night at his own home. Now, it was very...
That's not necessarily always the more troubled stay there. It's it's sometimes those are the kids that the parents don't want to deal with at all to stay there.
Well, what this school provided for the Muncy family was it made it sure that Tony had to attend class and that he had to go to school.
Right.
He wasn't a troubled youth because he was getting into trouble or committing criminal acts
that we know of.
He was just simply truant. He was skipping school.
Mm-hmm.
During the year at Rosemont, he became a very good student because he was attending class. He was a smart kid. But again, it didn't raise any flags with mom or dad when he didn't come home that night, because he did have his best friend live just a few houses down.
Uh-huh.
And they typically would roam the streets or go to the mall in the evening time. They would do what typical 15-year-old boys would do. And a lot of times, one of them would end up staying at the other one's home with little to no notice to the parents of the other.
Yeah, this is back in the time, too, where it's like you jump on your bicycle, you know, you jump on your bicycle and you just take off all day and your parents don't know where you're at or what you're doing. So it's more likely, but it's still odd that at nighttime, you don't know if he's staying there or staying at your house.
I think some of his behavior, as said, is why they suspected this. There was actually a couple of times the year before, this was before he started going to the Rosemont school, where Tony had kind of fake run away from home. He would be gone for a couple of days, a couple of nights, but he always returned on his own. This happened at least two times that I know of.
He's like a stray cat.
Yeah. Comes home when he's hungry.
Yeah.
Anyway, they didn't see their son that night. And it was when the announcement came out over the radio that an unidentified boy's body was found in Delaware County.
Yeah.
That Gladys Muncy called the sheriff's department.
And I wonder if they said boy or teen, because, I mean, that would, I guess, raise some red flags. I think the other thing, too, it depends on who's reporting it to you or if you're hearing it yourself on the radio. But also that mother's intuition thing might have been kicking in pretty hard.
Well, actually, since the last time you and I discussed this case, I did a little double checking and I found a account that one newspaper, we had three newspapers that reported on this back then in 1983.
Uh-huh.
And one of the newspapers actually specifically said that the announcement was that they had found an unidentified boy's body. And they knew they identified him as a young teenage boy.
Right.
So this kind of prompted a little more
Did they state that he was white?
They did not say that in the report.
Interesting. So in 1983, you were about 42, right?
Approximately.
Yeah.
Let's walk through Saturday, the day before Tony's body was found. On Saturday, Tony left his home at 4704 Janice Drive. This is on Columbus's east side, around 1:30 p.m. Now, the strange thing here is Tony had several sisters and a brother or two, so kind of a larger family. And the parents had arranged for a photographer to come by that morning or early afternoon to take pictures of the kids. They wanted to get kind of a group photo.
I mean, it's not weird to take a family portrait, but...
No, but it's weird how you read these cases and there's always some weird coincidence in there that there's photographs taken the day before somebody's killed.
Yeah.
And I mean, it makes it... One, it's a tragedy to begin with, but it just makes it more strange.
Mm-hmm.
So after the family photos, and they're saying, the parents and sisters are saying, Tony was his usual self. You know, he was joking around with the family. Uh-huh. He was kind of the funny guy of the family. And
he was the captain.
And he was, you know, joking with the photographer, putting everybody kind of in a good mood and making light of the whole situation.
Yeah.
After
kind of teasing his parents and stuff like that.
Yeah, after the photographer leaves,
mm-hmm.
Tony asked his father for some money. He wanted to get bus fare, and his father gave him a couple bucks. I have no idea what it cost to ride CODA, which is the Columbus, Ohio Transit Authority bus system. I don't know what it cost back in 1983 to ride the bus, but his girlfriend, Tony had a girlfriend that attended the same school as him. Now, his girlfriend was on that higher tier of trouble that we talked about. She lived and stayed at the school. Now, I think what they would do is, as like rewards, when you were good and you do the things that they ask you to do, that they would grant you like a weekend visit home.
Right.
So this was going to be Tony's girlfriend's first weekend visit home. Now, at school earlier that week, he had figured out that she's coming home, and he said, you know what? I'm going to come and see you at some point over the weekend. He tells his father he needs bus fare to go see his girlfriend who lives on the west side of Columbus.
That's probably a big deal for her, you know.
It sounds like to me that it might have been a big deal for Tony as well, that he was very excited to be able to go visit her at her home.
Well, and I'm to meet her family, but also it seems like here's this guy or this teenager that is now attending school, so he's getting his grades up and he's kind of getting his stuff together. Mm-hmm. And he meets this girl, troubled girl, and he's helping her get her life together as well, because obviously she is now getting to visit home.
Yeah, so things are moving in the right direction.
Correct. And so then he's going, okay, yeah, I'm going to meet your parents. And so this is kind of getting serious. I mean, that's pretty serious for a 15-year-old.
Yeah, so he gets the bus fare from his father, and then he walks off into the neighborhood, assuming that he was going to the bus station, or that he was going to go to the bus station soon. And like you had said earlier, these were the days where you kind of just went out and did your own thing as a kid. You know, people didn't worry so much about what you were out doing. These neighborhoods were considered safe. It was a safe area. And everybody considered this a good time to be alive and a good time to be a child. And his father had simply told him, just make sure you're home at dark.
Yeah.
You know, the old saying, once the street lights come on, you better be home.
Right. Get your ass home.
That was the last what the police would consider a credible sighting of Tony Muncy would be on that Saturday. Mm-hmm. There were several other reported sightings that the police seem to have deemed less credible for one reason or another. Those reasons are unclear, but we will still go through
the list
sightings.
Of those. Okay.
So one is a friend of the youth, a friend of Tony's, had claimed that he had seen Tony Saturday night around 8 p.m., he had seen them at the York Plaza, which I imagine is like a shopping mall, shopping center type thing back then. And I'm sure it happens still today. But a lot of teenagers would go and hang out at the mall, whether you had a dime to spend or not.
Right, right.
You just walk around with your friends. You would bump into people that you knew, say hi, catch up. What are you doing for the weekend? So forth. When he had saw Tony actually was with what the boy described as three 15 to 16-year-old boys. And the friend of Tony did not recognize any of these boys. Tony had asked the friend what the friend had done after the football game Friday night. And the friend said that Tony had seemed pretty cool, pretty, you know, normal for Tony. He was just right. Kind of there hanging out. Tony did not introduce the three boys to the friend, and all three of them walked away as Tony was speaking with him.
Right.
Tony did not tell the friend what he was doing at the plaza or where he intended to go afterwards.
And they didn't find this credible. For what reason? I mean, that seems like a pretty decent amount of conversation that you'd know who you're talking to.
Here's why they didn't find it credible.
Right.
Okay, you're exactly right. This is kind of a detailed description of somebody seeing somebody that they know, easy to identify somebody you know, especially by name, and you talk with them about events the day before or, yeah. You know, and you see them with other people. However, this is going to be a populated area. You know, there's a lot of people there on a Saturday night. Why I think that police believe this not to be a credible sighting is because they couldn't find anybody else there that had seen Tony as well. Tony's best friend, Dennis Emmers. Remember, we had said that the parents thought that he would have stayed the night at his good friend's home that lived in the neighborhood.
Yeah, a couple houses down.
Yep. So this is the good friend, best friend Dennis Emmers. He had told police that Tony had spoke with him and that Tony had told him that he had called the girlfriend earlier that Saturday to get directions. He was trying to figure out where exactly that she lived so he could go over there at some point.
Yeah, because he has to figure out the bus route too.
Yeah, exactly. And he told Dennis, you know, I'm going to go meet her, and then at some point at 8 p.m. tonight, around 8, I will be back in the neighborhood. They were supposed to hang out and just, you know, do their typical things together.
Well, he probably wanted to tell his buddy about visiting his girlfriend's house. They're 15 in 1983. this is something that they probably haven't done a million times. So this is exciting if you're a 15-year-old boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dennis tells police that Tony was going to return at 8 and we were going to hang out and find something to do. Now, Tony never shows up at 8 o'clock. Dennis Emmers never sees Tony that Saturday evening. Detectives tried retracing the boy's steps, but little was known of Tony's movement that day. After speaking with the Central Ohio Transit Authority, detectives could find no evidence or no bus driver that had seen the boy ever board a bus that day.
Yeah, that's probably hard too, because I mean, think about, it's a Saturday. How many kids or how many teenagers boarded a bus that day? And how many times did the bus driver just open up the door and not really pay attention?
Mm-hmm. Now, there was a rumor amongst teenagers that someone claimed to have seen Tony climb into a brown Chevette on Saturday evening, but this was never reported to police. This was reported to the newspapers.
Do you know where this is at? Was this closer to his home, or was this closer to like the bus stop or the bus station?
There was actually little to no more of a statement than what I just said.
To me, it would be him sitting at that bus station, somebody coming up that possibly doesn't know him, and what an easy target. You can pick off people that are at the bus stop, because guess who needs a ride?
Or it could have been in the York Plaza parking lot or near the shopping center on Tony's way to or from there.
Yeah, I have no reason to not believe that eyewitness. And when they say, well, nobody else saw him. Yeah, but one person saw him, and that's all you need.
The brown Chevette. We got to talk about the rumor of the brown Chevette. And the reason why this was not looked into deeper, that is because this was never reported to the police. It was reported to newspapers.
Uh-huh.
And the way that this worked was, it was kind of, the person that had told the newspaper that they had heard a rumor that Tony had climbed into a brown Chevette, that was seen climbing into the brown Chevette.
Right.
It was kind of like me telling you that somebody told me that they had seen him climbing into a car.
Right.
It wasn't me saying I saw him climb into a car. And to further muddle the waters more, the teenager, I don't know if it was a boy or a girl, that had told the newspaper, because they refused to give their name. A lot of the kids in the area were terrified. A lot of people thought that maybe, a lot of the kids thought that maybe Tony was just picked up on the street of their neighborhood,
right,
by some deranged lunatic, mm-hmm, that took him out into the middle of nowhere and cut him up.
Well, he was.
And they assumed that, you know, they assumed the worst, that he was raped, he was brutalized, and they thought that this person, whoever drove the brown Chevette,
right,
that they were going to just continue to drive around and pick up kids in,
right,
the neighborhood.
He goes missing on one day?
On a Saturday,
and his body's found
Sunday morning.
Right, so we're talking about like boom, boom.
Not even 24 hours
right,
later.
So then, right at that moment, there's rumors going, well, he's found, and he's pretty far, I mean, his body's pretty far from where he lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then all these gruesome details come through and you're going, fuck, I saw him get in the car, a brown Chevette too, but I'm not saying shit.
Well, not only that, think about how many kids would have known Tony. More than the average kid, in my opinion, because Tony lived in a neighborhood where a lot of the kids hung out together, did things together. So he was known in the neighborhood. Now, uh-huh, we know that he attended the Rosemont School because he was in trouble the year before.
Right.
He was attending a different school the year before.
Yeah, so he knows people from one
from
school.
From two sets of schools
Rosemont
and the neighborhood. So These kids went to school on Friday. Everything's normal. Most of them probably attended a football game. And they're all doing their normal teenager stuff, going to shopping centers and hanging out on the weekend. They return to school on Monday, whether it be Rosemont or Tony's old school,
right,
and they find out that Tony was abducted and he was killed and he was cut up in the middle of nowhere. These kids are terrified.
Yeah, because the rumor mill's not really spilling over on that Sunday.
No, can you?
Because we don't have social media. We're not calling people on cell phones.
Can you imagine Monday morning, the confusion that the kids are thinking when they hear this? Some of them might have heard it Sunday night, not knowing that it was Tony. But yeah, finding out on Monday that it was Tony, and then it's got to be this and that. It's got to be the kids going, well, what happened? Oh, I don't know. I saw him here. Or I heard he was here. I heard he was there.
Yeah, or just the hurt, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, your buddy is dead. And even if you're not going to school with him anymore, he's 15 years old. I mean, that's something that's really, you know, death gets a little easier to deal with, I think, as you get older.
Mm-hmm.
But when something hits that close to home and somebody your own age, that really bothers you. Or think about the people that are older than him that were friends with him. Now you got somebody that's younger than you that has now passed away. That really starts messing with your emotions.
And I'm sure that that would be why police were skeptical of the kid who had said that he had seen Tony at the York Plaza shopping center.
Right.
Because they're probably hearing multiple rumors. They probably heard all kinds of different stories from kids at either school or the neighborhood. I think the most credible person here is probably Dennis Emmers, his best friend that lived in the neighborhood, saying that, no, Tony had every intention of coming back to the neighborhood that night.
Right.
Something happened to him that prevented him from getting back to his best friend at 8 p.m.
Yeah, and I think the thing too is then something of this nature being probably the first time that this kind of stuff happens, especially in that area for those teenagers. So how many kids came out with stories just to be involved?
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's something new that it, you know, or again, just making up a story and then being questioned, like, you know, That happens a lot where a kid just goes, oh, yeah, I saw this. And then the teacher goes, oh, well, now you got to go talk to the cops.
And kid's they're going, like, oh, I didn't see anything.
Now I'm just going to lie through this story. So
yeah, because when you talk to your friends, you want to, you're the cool person.
You got to embellish a little bit.
If you knew what was going on, if you're in the know. The one lead that police had was Tony, his what he said earlier that day himself. He said he was going to go see his girlfriend, that he had called and got directions to her home. He asked for bus fare to go see the girlfriend.
Right.
So the sheriff's department, they badly want to talk to this girl and they want to talk to her family. Did he make it there? We can't find a bus driver that says that they saw Tony.
Yeah.
But let's go straight to the horse's mouth. Let's find out if...
I don't think you should call her a horse, but...
Let's find out if he had ever... you know, spoke to the girl or if he made it to her home. Now,
so what do we find?
This is where it gets very frustrating because this is 1983.
Uh-huh.
Tony lived in Columbus, Ohio. There's a Columbus Police Department. There's a Franklin County Sheriff's Department. They run the show here in Franklin County. They run the show in Columbus, right? Well, the body's found in Delaware County. And now you got these kind of smaller level, small town cops, Sheriff's Department, looking into this case.
Doesn't mean they're less credible.
It doesn't mean that they're less credible, but they
just don't deal with as many homicides.
But what it does mean is that for whatever reason, the Columbus Police Department and the Franklin County Sheriff's Department, they weren't so willing to just let the Delaware County Sheriff's Department come into their yard and play ball.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of, you know, put up roadblocks and speed bumps all over the place that hindered the investigation a bit. It wasn't until several days after the body was found that the sheriff in charge of this investigation was able to talk to the girlfriend.
Well, that's because she's in the custody of Franklin County Services.
Yes, you're exactly right. So when you live at the Rosemont School, you were technically in the custody of Franklin County.
Uh-huh.
So being that she is a youth, that she's not of legal age, she has to be supervised during this questioning, during the interview with her. So she is interviewed alongside of a attorney that is supplied by the Franklin County Children's Services.
And that's probably standard practice.
And now Franklin County would state clearly that this is not an attorney representing the girl. This is just somebody to take notes and observe.
And represent the state. It's kind of like a guardian ad litem.
You're exactly right. Now, nothing of any help comes of this interview.
And then the problem then becomes, if they were able to interview her 7 days earlier, was there something that she would remember? Who knows? But it was, what you say, 7 days?
It was several days.
Several days. I thought you said seven.
No, it was less than a week, but at least three or four days.
I mean, any time gap, you know, you're your memory starts getting foggy pretty quick.
Yeah, not only that, it becomes foggy onto, you know, yes, I could say that he called me, but was it on Saturday or was it on, you know, these things get confusing.
Yeah, well, then the other thing, too, is that she's, I'm assuming she's 15 as well.
She's his same age.
And so this is probably the first time she's being questioned in a homicide. And they're not pointing the finger at her saying that you killed him, but...
No, but they need information.
You think about how nerve-wracking that is.
She tells Detective Laverly, well, I should say Sheriff Lavery, that she did not see Tony that day, that Saturday.
Right.
That he had told her that he intended to visit her sometime that weekend, but she was uncertain of what time or what day he planned on dropping by the house.
Right. And that, look, the call to the, him saying, Tony saying that he called his girlfriend. I mean, that we don't need to put much weight on that, because he could have just been telling his buddy, oh yeah, well, you know, I looked up the bus route and I called her to get some directions.
But
then he's just being a dude and just like, I can find this shit on my own.
Or he simply told his friend Dennis that he knew where the girl lived and got directions from her. He may have got those directions while they were at school that week.
Yeah, yeah.
Bringing this together, Captain, we can agree that we believe Tony Muncy was going to go to his girlfriend's house that day. He was going to find a way to get there. He had told a friend that was his intention.
Yeah, told his best friend, told his parents, got money from his dad.
And when the girlfriend is interviewed by the sheriff, she says, I knew he was intending to visit me sometime that weekend. He didn't say when, but I think we got to go off of the assumption that that was his intentions that day. So something railroaded those plans. Something got in the way of him visiting his girlfriend. Something got in the way of him returning to his neighborhood to his friend Dennis Emmers at 8 p.m. that night. Now, what could have that been? That could have been several things. Tony could have been a sly, slick young man.
Uh-huh.
He could have got a few bucks from his dad to ride the bus and thought, you know what? Maybe I know an older boy that'd give me a ride, or I know somebody that I go to school with that I can bump into at the plaza or bump into him somewhere in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Maybe they'll give me a ride to my girlfriend's house and then I have a few bucks to hang out with her.
Maybe I'll try to hitchhike.
Yeah, maybe I'll try to hitchhike. And then you brought up something that's interesting. Maybe he just went to the bus station or went to a bus stop and he's standing there waiting for the bus and he was approached by somebody.
Yeah. I mean, it would be a good ruse.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, pull up and say, hey, I'm going that way anyway. Why don't you jump in? You know, and then you got a few bucks to hang out with your girlfriend.
And guess what? It doesn't matter if you're going that way or not.
Yeah. I'm not getting in your car.
No. But what I'm saying is for the guy trying to pick up Tony. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh yeah, going to the west side. We're on the east side. I'm going to the west side. That sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
And then, oh, by the way, it doesn't matter where the hell I'm going because we're not going there.
A day or two after Sunday, when Tony's body is found, an autopsy is performed, and they're able to determine several things. Now, we had said that the arms were cut off at the shoulders. However, we got to point out that what they truly revealed was that the arms were cut off at the shoulders, but they were cut again at the elbows. So two arms and four pieces.
Right.
Now, what they had stated was that this was not the work of a surgeon. You know, that the removing of the arms from the body was not the work of a surgeon. But it didn't look like they had used an axe either. You know, it wasn't a total hack job.
Right. Somewhere in between.
So what they also found was his bloody shirt had a hole in the back. They were able to determine that Tony Muncy was stabbed in the back. They believe that this was probably the initial attack, that he wasn't looking at his attacker. He was attacked from behind. They were able to stab him in the back, take him down, and gain control over Tony. Now, when the arms were cut off, the clothing had already been removed from the body.
Right.
He had suffered multiple stab wounds to the front of his abdomen, and it looked like overkill. I mean, this was like 30-some stab wounds, and the stomach was cut open. They also found slices or stab marks on the legs. They're kind of described as both, but whatever. They believe that the intention there was to try to remove the legs from the body as well.
Right, so sever the legs. And so you got severed arms and severed legs.
The body was completely devoid of blood when they found it. There was no blood in the body, no blood in any of the pieces of the body as well. It was so absent of blood that they did not find any blood in the heart either. And this is one of the last locations that you would lose blood from.
This also means that this happened, the draining actually happened pretty quickly after the death.
Yeah, and it obviously had to have happened elsewhere because they didn't find any blood at the scene other than the dried blood that was on the clothing.
Right.
There was a rumor floating around amongst teenagers that Tony might have been seeking marijuana that evening or trying to locate some marijuana that weekend. Now, they did find in the autopsy, they were able to determine that there was marijuana or THC in the boy's system. You know, they don't know exactly when this was found, but they were able to use tissue samples to determine the presence of THC in the body.
So maybe the idea was, I'm going to tell everybody I'm going to go visit my girlfriend, but I'm not really going to go visit my girlfriend.
Might just be going out to get high with some buddies.
Right.
Yeah, could be.
Which would make sense by seeing him at the mall.
Or one thing, you know, I did discuss this. We've mentioned a friend of the show several times, a guy we call the Skipper. He's a former detective, retired detective. He has investigated homicides in many other cases as well. Not this particular case, but when we reviewed...
But knows a lot of people that were involved in this case.
Correct, because he was a detective, an active police officer at the time of this case and in somewhat in the area. So when he reviewed the information that we gave him, now keep in mind, we're not able to give him the police file because this is an unsolved case. They don't just willy-nilly hand out the file to two guys that drink beer in their garage.
I mean, sometimes they do, but you gotta lube them up a little bit.
Exactly. You gotta give them a lot of beer.
Yeah.
You gotta invite them to the garage.
And we don't have that much money in the beer fund, so we just couldn't do it.
Yeah. So we were able to provide the Skipper with all of the newspaper accounts of the time and anything that we could find on the internet regarding this case. He reviewed the information, and one thing that he had mentioned there was, you got to keep in mind, Nick, that the kid Tony went to a school for troubled youths. He said he may not have found any marijuana or smoked any marijuana that night. This stuff stays in your system for a couple of weeks. He very well could have smoked some marijuana in the bathroom at the school that he was attending, or he could have, you know, smoked some weed after school with one of his buddies.
Yeah, or he could have done it that day before he left on his journey to see his girlfriend. And I wouldn't say that stays in your system always weeks. I'd say days. So I'd say within a 3-day time period or so.
The other thing that they were able to determine that Tony was not sexually assaulted, and the mutilation that occurred to the body, this occurred post-mortem, that he was dead when most of the mutilation took place.
Yeah, that's what they suspect.
The severing of the arms in particular. Now, why is the marijuana thing important? Well, we got to think of the times, man. Back in 1983, you know, marijuana was considered a lot more heinous than it is today. You know, and there, keep in mind, 1983, regardless of the time, when a boy, 15-year-old boy, is killed and left in this manner on the side of the road, there is a lot of pressure on police to solve this case and to get this creep off of the streets before he can do it again.
Right.
So there's all this pressure to solve the case. They release that, you know what? He might have been looking for marijuana that night, and we found it in his system. What does this do? This changes the general public's perception of this case. Maybe not everybody's, but some of their perceptions.
Right.
And what that becomes is, well, maybe, you know, this kid was he's a troubled youth. He was a drug addict.
Right.
He was out looking for drugs. He was hanging out with the wrong people. He got what was coming to him. Not only did he get what was coming to him, but this was a drug-related death.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've been reading true crime for a long time. I don't know too many cases where somebody cut up a body over marijuana.
Yeah, I couldn't name one off the top of my head.
Seems strange to me. And then on top of that, how much money, if robbery was the motive, how much money could have Tony Muncy had on his person at the time? What did he did?
Maybe $5.
He had a bum bus fare off of his father.
Right.
How much is it to ride the bus? It's not like taking a taxi cab today, you know, where you're going to spend $50 or $60 to get your drunk ass home from a bar at the end of the night. No, this is a kid riding public transportation on a bus. What, a dollar? What does it cost? A dollar? $2? I have no idea, but it's got to be peanuts, man. So this kid, he didn't have a job, and he's walking around with bus fare. I can't believe that robbery is the motive. And he clearly has no drugs on his person if he's out looking for some. And if he did, how much weed does he have on him?
Right.
I mean, can you, back then, could you get a joint for $2? Maybe.
I don't know.
But you don't saw somebody's arms off for a joint.
I mean, you were 42 at the time. I was 2.
Police have little to go on. But a suspect does present himself. And this suspect's name is Timothy Edward Hall. Captain, roll the clip for Timothy Hall. The early morning of December 2nd, 1983. Timothy Hall went to the home of a man who had tried to help him, a 50-year-old blind man. Hall forced his way into the home and up the stairs. He was looking for a girl who was into witchcraft, a girl who had been killed and burned. He was going to get the box containing her ashes so he could put her back together. When he came back down the stairs, he grabbed the man and bit his face. He stabbed the man 20 times and hit him over 40 times with a blunt object. He slit the man's throat, poured boiling hot coffee on his head, and dumped dirt on the man's body. When Timothy Hall was locked in his cell for the brutal slaying, he often spoke loudly, arguing with a man named John. But there was no one there. The attack that we just described took place on December 2nd, 1983. That was less than 2 months after the body of Tony Muncy is found in Delaware County. That crime took place in Columbus. This was Timothy Hall. He slashed the throat and killed Herbert Campbell. Campbell was a 50-year-old blind man. He was robbed and killed at his home. Can I be a little more specific about that actual crime? I know we covered it in the clip there. But what took place was Timothy Hall knew Herbert Campbell. And he had showed up to Campbell's home that evening. He was knocked on the door, asked if he could come in. Herbert Campbell tried to help out the young man. He knew he was troubled, but it was cold out. You know, it's December. He says, come on in. He lets him in for a little bit. He supplies him with some cigarettes and coffee to warm him up. And here's the thing. Timothy Hall is, for lack of a better term, he's batshit crazy. And anytime he's around anybody, he can seem normal for a little bit, but he will start to go off and start to talk about crazy things.
Yeah, he has some mental illness.
Earlier that day, he was with Campbell's, with his son or his daughter, and hanging out with them. And while he's around them, he starts saying things like, you know, I'd like to steal a police car and crash it, you know, and if I could find a shotgun in the police car,
yeah,
I'm going to use it to like kill some cops.
Oh.
So I mean, this is the kind of, like, that was dinner conversation for Timothy Hall, you know, and I'm sure that wasn't the first thing that he said. They probably sat down, had normal conversation.
I mean, he might have started with like pass the potatoes.
Exactly. You know? And then it leads to, I'd like to kill some cops. So
that's not a normal dinner for me.
He's at Campbell's home. They're drinking coffee. He's giving him cigarettes, you know, trying to warm up the kid. And I say kid because Timothy Hall was young at the time. He was about 18 years old. Mm-hmm. Now, after Hall is in Campbell's home for a bit of time, he starts talking crazy. He starts saying weird, strange things. Now, Herbert Campbell calls the police and he tells them, look, I know this kid. I was trying to help him out. He's in my home. He's acting like a lunatic. I'm afraid of him. I'm really afraid of this kid. And I shouldn't have let him in my home, but it was cold out. I felt bad for him. Can you please come here and get him? So the police show up and they remove Timothy Hall from the home.
Yeah.
Well, as Timothy Hall is being hauled out of there, he says, you know, I'm, you know, Campbell, I'm going to get you for this. And, you know, spouting out threats to him. It might have been a good idea if the police were able to charge him with anything or hold him for the night. It would have been a great idea to put him in a cell for the evening. Because right. what took place was a few hours later, he goes back to the home of Campbell. Now, Campbell reluctantly lets him in. It's a little unclear if he let him in or if Timothy Hall might have stormed his way in.
Yeah, he's also blind. So, I mean, it'd be a lot easier to... you know, trick your way in.
As soon as Timothy Hall gets into the home, he starts saying crazy shit right away. He's saying, I'm going to go upstairs. Campbell's saying, you cannot go upstairs. I don't really want you in my house. I'm going to call the police again. Hall says that he's going upstairs because there is a girl up there that was into witchcraft. And this girl is dead. That Campbell had killed a girl and he had burned her body. And Hall knew that the ashes were upstairs, and he was going to go retrieve the box that the girl's ashes were in because he wanted to put the girl back together again.
So, yeah, this is what Hall is saying.
Yes. And this is...
Did we ever find this box?
There was no box. There was no ashes.
Mm-hmm.
He goes upstairs. He comes back
that
down.
That doesn't mean there is not a box somewhere.
Well, there probably... ashes. Yeah, exactly. So Hall comes back down the stairs... but let's be clear. Campbell has not killed any girl, you know, that we know of.
Well, that we know of.
But Timothy Hall is batshit crazy. This right. is just a lunatic spouting off things. He's arguing with a blind old man that's trying to help him. So Hall comes back down the stairs and he starts a physical fight with Campbell. And at this time, this is when he grabs him. He bites him in the head. He picks...
Yeah, which is crazy.
Timothy Hall... Timothy Hall's not a very large man. He's kind of a smaller man at the time. And his police photos and his prison photos to this day, he's pretty kind of scrawny and meek looking. And his years in prison have wore on him because he looks quite sickly. Anyway, but at the time, like I said, he was an 18-year-old young man. He picks up a table and he throws it. Well, this breaks the table, and it's like a wooden coffee table.
Right.
This breaks off one of the little wooden legs that's on the table. He uses this table leg to beat Herbert Campbell, and he hits him over 40 times with this item.
Oh, yeah.
He goes into the kitchen. He gets a knife.
Mm-hmm.
He slits Campbell's throat, and then he stabs him about 20-some times.
Oh.
While... Campbell is lying there bleeding to death. He further degradates the body by he's picking up flower pots that are around the home and he's dumping the dirt and the plants onto the body.
Trying to bury him.
And he's taking hot coffee.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same coffee that Campbell just recently made for Timothy Hall.
Yeah, to warm him up.
Scalding hot coffee, and he's dumping it on Campbell's face and on his chest.
And we assume at this point he's already dead.
What the police were able to determine was that he lie there suffering an agonizing death while he bled to death. That this was not something that went
he died
fast.
Quickly from, yeah.
So Hall robs the home and he leaves the house. How does Hall get picked up by police? He goes to a nearby gas station. And he locks himself into the bathroom. You know how some of the gas stations back then had the outdoor bathroom, and some of them you had to ask for the key, some of them you didn't have to ask for the key? He goes into this bathroom, and he locks himself in the bathroom. He's in that bathroom for almost a half an hour, and the people working at the gas station are like, what the hell?
Right.
They call police. Police show up, and they knock on the door. Hall eventually lets them into the bathroom. He opens up the door. And police notice that he's covered in blood. And they say to him, what's all that blood on you? Well, Hall says, hey, look, I cut my hand, which he probably did when he was stabbing Campbell. I cut my hand. It's blood that's on my shirt. That's what you're seeing. And And he, but then he goes on to tell police that it might not be just my blood.
Yeah.
That there's the, there could be, you know, hinting that there could be somebody else's blood.
Seems like Hall goes in and out of being crazy.
Yeah. You know? And they ask, the police say, okay, well, now they want to know where he's been that night because he's covered in blood and he's already stated it might not just
shouldn't,
be my blood.
Shouldn't they already know? Because
well, yeah, that they were up. Called to the house. Yeah. Well, it might not have been the same exact officers. They might not have actually identified the person as Timothy Hall at the time. Anyway, Hall tells them that he was at Campbell's home. And they said, well, what's Campbell doing now? And he says, he's probably dead. And that he's an old man. He's over the hill and he's probably dead. So, of course, they go to the home of Herbert Campbell and they do find the body there. They bring Timothy Hall in for interrogation. They want to know everything that happened. It's pretty obvious that he's probably guilty of this. He confesses pretty early into the questioning.
Mm-hmm.
When they asked him how he felt about killing Campbell, he said, you know, it was a new experience for me. It was the first time I had ever done something like this. And I really enjoyed it. I loved it, actually.
Huh.
They ask him, why did you...
In all fairness, I think he's pretty mentally ill.
They ask him, why did you dump, you know, dirt and coffee on him while he was lying there? Why did you continue to stab him and beat him after you'd already slit his throat? And he said simply that, you know, I wanted to hurt him more. I wanted to make him feel... I wanted to hurt him worse, was his exact words.
Right. And this is a guy that tried to help you out hours earlier.
Police went on and they wanted to know, what did you take from Campbell's home? And Timothy Hall says, I took money, I took cigarettes, and I took his life. And that was about all I needed to take.
Right.
And he went on to tell them that he thought that he did a good job killing Campbell, that he was satisfied with what he had done.
Mm-hmm.
Timothy Hall is going to go to trial for the murder of Herbert Campbell. Now, during the course, it's not too long into this trial where the judge says, you know what? This guy is a lunatic. He's incompetent. He doesn't understand what's going on. We cannot try him. What they are able to do is they are able to lock him in a mental institute. Now, this is not just your regular, you know, white building that looks like a country club, you know, where everybody's just kind of drugged up and walking around watching Geraldo. This is a maximum security mental facility. He is there and he's diagnosed with schizophrenia. Now, while he is in his cell, the prison guards observe him on multiple occasions talking very loudly and arguing with a man that he calls John. Now, there's nobody there. There's nobody near Timothy Hall.
I mean, nobody that you can see.
He's arguing with a ghost.
Right.
Now, let's keep in mind, Tony's real name is John Anthony Muncy. This took place, the death of Herbert Campbell takes place less than 2 months after they find Tony Muncy's body. They have no leads. This all of a sudden becomes a lead. Timothy Hall becomes number one suspect.
Yeah, but I don't know how much sense that makes.
So now they need to try to connect the two. And what they are doing, they're talking to the family, they're talking to friends of Tony Muncy. Now, what they are told, and it's specifically by the family says it's likely that Tony would have known Timothy Hall, that they would have known each other through drug dealings, through, you know, being in the same circles, right. Hanging out with weird, troubled kids. That are smoking pot and doing other things. Now, the rumor was that they believed that some of the blood that was found on the articles of clothing that were found with Tony's body, that some of the blood could have been Timothy Hall's. And they were going to test it to see if they could determine that. Now, they announced that they're going to test it. They never announced the results of the test. My speculation is either they didn't test it, they screwed it up and botched it somehow, or
contamination.
Contamination, yeah. And it came back inconclusive.
Or it's just not his blood, you know.
They, exactly. Maybe the test didn't go in their favor and they didn't want to bring it up because they thought that they would be taking Timothy Hall to trial at some point. If anybody can find anything more on Timothy Hall, I'd love to hear. But what I can give you an update on is that Timothy Hall is currently serving time in the state of Ohio, and he was sentenced to 15 years to life. Eventually, he was found competent to stand trial, and he's serving 15 years to life for the murder of Herbert Campbell. He has said he's an inmate in the state of Ohio. He has been denied parole at least once, maybe twice. His next parole hearing, though, is August of 2018. So this is not a guy that we want on the streets.
No.
I tell you that because he's diagnosed schizophrenic. And this is not, I don't want to sound like I'm attacking people that have this disability.
Sounds like to me.
But what I'm saying, though, is not all schizophrenic people are violent. He right. is clearly a violent, violent person.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't just accidentally shoot Herbert Campbell. He destroyed Herbert Campbell. And he mutilated the body and afterwards.
So, I mean, other than some speculation that he might have known some people through drug dealings, that's the only way he would have known Tony.
That's, yes. And the family was the one to agree that he would have known Timothy.
Well, and they tested the DNA and they didn't, or the blood, and obviously there's no link there, or they would have brought that up. The way that Tony's body is, you know, cut up, put in bags, and then disposed of is completely opposite of Hall's killing.
You're exactly
and
right.
And also Hall stated that that was his first killing. I actually believe him. Again, I know he's, you know, mentally unstable, but I think he goes back and forth between crazy and not crazy.
Yeah, I think he would probably end up killing again if he's ever released. And I agree with you. It's exactly, it's not anywhere near the way that Muncy was killed. I mean, you're talking about whoever killed Muncy, it sounds pretty thought out to me. You know, it sounds like he was attacked from behind, and then once he's taken down.
I don't know if the killing is thought out, but the disposal is definitely thought out.
Exactly, exactly. They took some time to take the body apart, to wrap it up, to dispose of it, where Hall had just simply lost his mind and attacked Campbell and destroyed him.
I mean, he's looking for ashes of a woman that was burned alive, a witch,
right?
Basically,
somebody else that he probably made up, that some imaginary person that he dreamt up, maybe another ghost that he talks
to. So I don't really like Hall as my number one suspect. Let's get to the number two.
Well, Hall is still listed as a suspect in the case, but there is another suspect. And this person is somebody that really tips the scales here because he is somebody that is described by multiple law enforcement agencies as probably the most dangerous man, dangerous criminal that these people have ever encountered. And I'm talking about William Wickline Jr. William Wickline Jr. was described by law enforcement as the most dangerous criminal in the state. In August of 1982, Wickline and his live-in girlfriend arranged for a night of partying with Christopher and Peggy Lurch. The four friends spent the night drinking and doing cocaine. The next morning, Wickline asked Christopher to take a look at his bathtub as there seemed to be a problem with the drain. Christopher agreed. He walked into the bathroom, knelt down by the tub, and leaned his head in to look into the drain. Wickline walked up behind Christopher and slit his throat. Christopher never saw it coming, and he bled out in the tub. Wickline would not risk leaving Peggy as a witness. He grabbed a rope and ordered his girlfriend to hold Peggy down. Wickline climbed on top of Peggy, wrapped the rope around her neck, and strangled her to death. He spent the next several hours cutting up the bodies into small pieces. Wickline drove around Columbus disposing of the bodies in garbage bins, one piece at a time. January 25th, 1984, William Wickline Jr. is arrested for burglarizing a pharmacy in Nelsonville, Ohio. the Nelsonville police were tipped off by Teresa Kemp. Now, Teresa Kemp was Wickline's old girlfriend. Upon further questioning, Kemp turned evidence that Wickline had murdered Christopher and Peggy Lurch. So let's go through this real quick. Now, Nelsonville is not a very big police department. And
I just dropped all my notes.
Nelsonville is not a very big police department. And what they had said was, thank God that this robbery was taking place during the shift change. Because during the shift change, the two guys that are on duty are leaving, but they're still there while they're waiting on the two guys that are going to take over to show up.
Mm.
So now you've doubled your police force from 2 to 4 cops.
Yeah.
Okay, so Wickline and his friend, his accomplice, they were burglarizing a pharmacy. Now, of course, they were hoping to receive, to get money out of this burglary, but they also wanted to take as many narcotics and pharmaceuticals as they could.
Yeah.
Because who is Wickline? Wickline is a hardened criminal. He's a career criminal that deals in drugs and cocaine.
Yeah, and this is early 80s, so there's a lot of stuff like Quaaludes and stuff like that that were really popular at the time, and pharmaceuticals were getting more and more popular in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, and he dealt in the hard stuff, and he knew how to move the hard stuff, and he also was involved in several burglaries, robberies, threatening people, menacing people. He was known to law enforcement anywhere. He kind of moved around Ohio a little bit.
He's a real bad dude.
He was from Reynoldsburg, Ohio, which is a suburb of Columbus.
Uh-huh.
And he was known to the Columbus police. He was between 6'3" and 6'4". He was described as bull-necked with a mustache and kind of shoulder-length hair.
Mm.
Bull-necked meaning if you see a picture of him when he's in his early 20s, his neck is thicker than his head. He's got a very hardened criminal look to him. He's got these eyes.
He has eyes.
Well, no, but
he has eyes.
Law enforcement later would say he was the kind of guy that if you looked him in the eye or you saw his eyes, you could kind of get a glimpse of what he was capable of.
Okay. You could see pure evil.
Exactly. So he is arrested for this burglary. They're trying to get narcotics. They pick him up, and now he's behind bars. His old girlfriend, Teresa Kemp, is scared to death of Wickline.
Yeah.
She's scared to death of him. But now that he's behind bars, she feels safe to say to the cops, look, he killed these two people that we know. This was Christopher and Peggy Lurch. Now, as said, they were over the night before partying. They stayed the night at Wickline's apartment with his girlfriend, Teresa Kemp. They woke up that morning. Now, the night before, after they're kind of drug-induced and kind of drunk, Wickline starts bringing up some kind of disagreement that him and Christopher Lurch had about missing $6,000. I don't know if Wickline owed him $6,000 or if he was owed $6,000.
Yeah, maybe they did a robbery together.
$6,000 was coming into question. Uh-huh. And I guess the more drunk, the more high that they got.
Mm.
At some point, Christopher Lurch had mentioned how he had had sex with Wickline's girlfriend.
Well, this is going really good.
Well, this is not a good idea because in the morning, I guess all is forgotten as far as Christopher Lurch is concerned, but not Wickline. Wickline says to Christopher Lurch that there's a problem with my bathtub. There's something in the drain or something stopping up at the drain. Could you come and take a look at this for me?
Well, he honey-dicked him is what he did.
Yeah.
And he said, we're cool. Don't worry about it. Let's party.
Lurch goes into the bathroom. He kneels over. He looks down into the drain. Wickline comes up behind him with a knife and slices his throat. And at that point, the body's just going to fall right into the bathtub and you're just going to let him bleed out. It's actually pretty efficient and clean if you want to give anybody kudos for that. Now, what he decides is that Peggy is going to be a witness, that there's no way that Peggy can't go home without her husband because then somebody's going to know that something is up.
Right.
So he tells Teresa Kemp, Peggy's still passed out from the night before at this point.
I'm sure he doesn't sound like that when he says it, but go ahead.
What did I sound like?
He said, oh, honey. Honey.
So, no, he commands Teresa Kemp to hold Peggy down. He says, hold her legs down. And he gets a rope and he strangles her to death.
Yeah.
Afterwards, Teresa Kemp is kind of out of it at this point. She doesn't want to know what's going on. She tells police, I only helped him do that because I'm scared to death of William Wickline.
Yeah, well, he just killed somebody.
And not only that, the police do not have a hard time believing that she's scared to death of him because I think they were scared to death of him as well.
Right.
He takes Peggy's body. He's alone with the bodies for a few hours. And during this time, he's cutting them up into the smallest pieces that he can. Teresa says she doesn't know how many pieces that he cut them into, but that he left the home carrying multiple trash bags that were full of little pieces.
Right. He's just going to sprinkle them around the city.
When he came home, there were no more trash bags with Wickline Jr. He had evidently went around in garbage bins and dumpsters and put them out one piece at a time because these two people were never seen, heard from, no evidence found against them ever again. No, they never found a single part of these people.
Right. Just cleaned off the face of the earth.
Correct. So he's in prison for that, and now people start coming out of the woodwork. Everybody who was afraid of Wickline is now approaching police and saying, look, he's involved in other crimes. He's involved in other murders. He's actually, Wickline, if you include the murders of the Lurch couple, he's suspected of 5 to 6 murders.
Yeah.
One or two of these people are unidentified. One of the persons is a man down in Florida. There was a rumor amongst the drug community, the drug dealing community, that Wickline had been hired, had been contracted to go down to Florida to take care of somebody. He had told people when he came back here that he did take care of that person, that he honored that contract. And that person was, in fact, found dead. Now, they found no evidence to take anybody to court for it. But there's rumor that Wickline killed this man. Furthermore, in the state of West Virginia, for our overseas listeners, West Virginia is the state right next door to Ohio. There was a man killed, a drug dealer that was killed in Parkersburg, West Virginia. This took place in November of 1979. His name, the victim's name, was Charles Marsh. Now, who was Charles Marsh? He was nicknamed Swampy, I'm guessing because his last name was Marsh. And he hung around with a rough crowd. You know, he's a big-time drug dealer in West Virginia. What took place was somebody had either worked their way into his home or busted into his home. And they had killed, somebody had killed Charles Marsh in his bed. Yeah. So Swampy's found in his bed. His hands are bound. He was handcuffed. But he's decapitated. And next to the bed is a nightstand. Somebody had taken the head of Charles Marsh and placed it on the nightstand. And they didn't just like throw it onto the nightstand. They placed it in a manner that if you walked through the door, Herbert Marsh's face was looking at you when you walked through the door. And then you would see his headless body sitting right next to the face. Not only was the face looking at you at the door, somebody had taken the time after they removed his head to comb the hair of the head before they positioned it onto the nightstand. Now, the entire home was ransacked. I mean, whoever did this, they were looking for drugs and money. The whole place was tore apart. Drawers open, everything. Clothes everywhere. The place was ripped apart. Now, the strange thing here is, I don't know. I'm assuming that they probably found some drugs. I'm assuming they probably found some money. But the strange thing here is, Swampy lay there headless, dead in the bed. And the very mattress that he is lying on, the police find $30,000 in cash underneath that mattress. Jeez. Somebody forgot to check the mattress.
Yeah, that's good beer fund money.
So there are people in drug circles that are now telling on Wickline and saying that Wickline was the guy that was there. And actually, West Virginia, the police in Parkersburg, they come up with enough evidence that they figure out that they can try William Wickline Jr. for this. But this is after he is sentenced for the death of Christopher and Peggy Lurch in the state of Ohio. Now, the way that they worked this out was nobody wanted Wickline on the streets again. The state of West Virginia and the state of Ohio both agreed, this guy, we got to do everything in our power to make sure that he never...
Yeah, he's just pure evil.
He never sees daylight again. We need him under our control because he will kill anybody that gets in his way of anything at all.
Yeah.
So the agreement that is made, West Virginia does not want to indict him on this and take him to court. I screwed that up. They do indict him, but they do not want to take him to trial. Why? Because they don't have the death penalty. Both states agree that everybody's better off in the long run if Wickline is killed, if he's dead. So they decide that, you know what? This killing of Swampy took place before the deaths of the Lurch couple. So they decide that we need him to stay under the custody of the state of Ohio until they kill him. So what we're going to do is we're going to indict him, but we don't want to try him. Now, they make a deal with Wickline's attorney because what they're afraid of is if for some reason on appeals or whatever, Wickline gets out of the Ohio State Penitentiary, that they would have to try him then and they would lose the case because they did not observe Wickline's right to a speedy trial. Wickline and his attorney waived their right to a speedy trial. So actually, the prosecutor in West Virginia, about once a month, they have to go to a judge and they have to ask to continue the indictment. There's an ongoing continued indictment of William Wickline Jr. They had to do this for 18 years while they waited for Wickline to be executed by the state of Ohio.
But he was executed.
Yes, he has been executed. But I do want to point out that what kind of level this dude was on. Because after the trial, he says, as soon as he's found guilty, he says, if I ever get out of prison, I'm wrongfully convicted. I'm going to kill the judge. I'm going to kill the prosecutor. I'm going to kill my defense attorney. I'm going to kill my girlfriend that testified against me. And I'm going to kill every one of the detectives and police that were involved in this investigation.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't help your case if you're ever going to try to get out of prison. But this terrified law enforcement.
It was this really bad joke he's making.
Well, this terrified law enforcement to the point where the detectives that were involved in the case, they went to the prosecutor. And they told the prosecutor, you have to guarantee us, you have to give us your word that if for some reason Wickline ever gets out of prison, we are notified before he leaves those walls. That our families, even if we're still not around,
why would he get out of prison?
It doesn't matter. But what I'm saying is they're saying for whatever reason at all, maybe the federal government changes all the rules one day and just opens up the doors. They want to be notified before he's on the streets.
Yeah.
And if they're not around, they want their families notified because everybody's terrified of this dude. And not only that, the prison guards refuse to be alone with Wickline. They would not bring him into a room. They would not go into a room with him. They wanted to have multiple officers available to control him and watch him at all times.
Maybe he was stinky, you know?
No, he was big. He was 6'3", 6'4". He had long arms, and he was just violent in nature. And not only that, he threatened everybody. And furthermore, as we said, if you stood in his way or you wronged him, he would kill you.
Right. Okay, so how's he involved with Tony?
Well, okay.
He involved with Tony?
Well, we'll get into that in just a minute. As I said, he was suspected of 5 to 6 homicides. All of these victims were either dismembered or decapitated or both. And actually, he was nicknamed the Butcher. Now, that is why he would be involved with Muncie. This is how they're going to make... It's a bit of a leap, but let's keep in mind, he was in the Central Ohio area at the time of that Muncie disappeared and was killed.
No record of him killing a teenager, though.
What ended up happening is they contact Tony's family. Now, once again, Tony's family agrees and says that, you know what? Yes, it's likely that Tony would have known Wickline because they ran in certain drug circles. I think we need to point some things out here. I think that this is a bit of a sign of the times, okay? Early 1980s, I think that there was some thought amongst people that, and I don't think that law enforcement fully believed this, but I think that a lot of people thought that, you know, that there's only a small community of people that are buying and selling and doing drugs.
Right.
And they must all know each other, right? Because there's only a small community. Well, that's not the case. And we found, what did we find in Tony Muncy's body? We found marijuana, man. We found weed.
Right.
Wickline didn't mess around. He might have smoked weed, but this guy was a true criminal. He was a career criminal. He's not playing around with selling a dime bag to a 15-year-old boy.
Right.
He's not robbing a 15-year-old boy. He's dealing with cocaine. He argued with $6,000 with Christopher Lurch.
Yeah, which
he
was probably drug money.
He was looking for $30,000 in the home of Swampy. So this is a guy that dealt in high amounts of money, probably with large amounts of heavy-duty drugs.
Yeah. It does. He just doesn't make any sense to me, unless for some reason they just happened to cross paths, and then Tony for some reason ran his mouth to him. But why would he try to piss off a guy that's 6'3", 6'4"?
There was a rumor, and I don't know if this was started by the police or if it was started by neighborhood kids or where this rumor came from, but there was a rumor that Wickline was in the process of robbing a convenience store or a pharmacy or something of that nature on that Saturday night, and that Tony had stumbled onto the scene or been in the parking lot and would have seen this take place.
Right.
And that Wickline, being the evil man that he is, didn't want to leave any witnesses, abducted Muncy, cut him up and dumped his body. There's some problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
So he chooses to abduct the 15-year-old boy and take him out and cut him up. Where's the dead convenience store clerk? You know, these are other things that would have taken place that night. There would have been other evidence of that. And furthermore, and I think you and I can agree on this, and most of the people listening would agree on this too. What have we seen by William Wickline Jr.? If he doesn't want your body found, it's not going to be found. If he was involved in Tony Muncy's killing, they would have never found Tony Muncy's body. Yeah. He wouldn't have stopped halfway cutting up the kid. He would have finished the job. He was.
And that's some other speculation that was made by the skipper.
Correct. He agreed with us on that speculation as well. Now you say, well, they found Swampy's body. He wanted Swampy's body to be found. That was a message. He cut off the damn head and combed the hair and set it on the nightstand. That's a message to other drug dealers, to whoever robbed him or wronged him. That's a message to everybody out there that Wickline doesn't take any shit. Regardless if you are for or against the death penalty, let's not get into that argument, okay? This is an instance where it needed to be done. And I thank my lucky stars that William Wickline Jr. was executed by the state of Ohio. This took place March 30th, 2004.
Wow. Enjoy that hate mail.
Yeah, I welcome it in this situation. And I'll tell you what, can I go through the last meal? You know I like the last meal.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, William Wickline Jr.'s last meal was an 8-ounce filet mignon cooked medium rare, potato salad, 6 rolls with butter, fresh strawberries over shortcake, and butter pecan ice cream. He also had 4 packs of Pall Mall cigarettes and 6 cans of Mountain Dew soda. And the argument would be that we shouldn't have spent our taxpayer dollars to grant this animal with a final request for a good meal before we execute him. I can agree with that argument. But let's observe here. We only spent a small amount of change on his last meal. The steak was provided by the prison kitchen, so it couldn't have been that great of a steak or an expensive cut of meat. The rest was store-bought, and they paid a total of $11.66 to provide him with his last meal. Now, Wickline's last words before being executed were, "May the tomorrow see the courts shaped by more wisdom and less politics." William Wickline Jr. was never tried. He was never put on trial for the death of Tony Muncy, and actually, they didn't find much evidence to link him to the crime.
I think it's because he's not linked.
But for a year or so, he was considered a prime suspect. Some of law enforcement still consider him the number one suspect in Tony Muncy's death to this day. However, as said, Wickline's been executed, and that trial will never happen.
All right, let's get to my number one suspect.
Okay, so there was a third suspect. And just to be clear, we are presenting these suspects in the order that the sheriff announced them to the media. So the first one that they came up with was Timothy Hall. They investigated that for a while. He's in jail. He's in prison for a murder. That kind of goes cold.
It's a little wacky.
Yep. Wickline is now in prison for a double homicide. That goes cold a little bit, too. And now we have...
He's executed.
Yep. But well before his execution, the sheriff, Sheriff Lavery, would have a third suspect. Now, this suspect was a suspected serial killer. Now, he was from the Illinois area, and his name was Larry Eiler. Larry Eiler was a brutal killer who roamed the American Midwest, picking up hitchhikers and male prostitutes and hacking them to death. Larry wanted to get young men in his car and drive them to the middle of nowhere, spend the night raping and torturing them for as long as he could. Discarding their mutilated bodies in cornfields, abandoned barns, and on the side of country roads. Sometimes burying the bodies in clusters with weird ritual trappings. The highway murders spanned 4 states and 14 counties, and even after police identified their prime suspect, the murders continued. 13 more young men were savagely attacked and tortured. It seemed as if the stalker was unstoppable, until he took his killing home. Larry Eiler. He was a house painter. He worked at a liquor store. He was a clerk at a liquor store. He was a weightlifter. And he was known to be somebody that was fond of wearing Marine t-shirts, you know, the U.S. Marines. But he had never served in the armed forces.
Yeah, that's a big crime that's happening lately, is people coming out saying that they served in the military, which they never did.
So, like, you, for what? Like, you wear a Marine shirt and you're at Lone Star Steakhouse and somebody buys your meals? Is that what people are doing?
Yeah. Or they even go further than that. Sometimes they'll have patches and everything.
Well, that's despicable.
It is.
Anyway, I think he wore them because he liked the style of the shirt, that it was a tight-fitting shirt. You know, he was kind of a muscular guy, and he enjoyed weightlifting. He was one of the darkest, most evil people. I mean, we talk about some really bad dudes. We just talked about Wickline Jr. And this guy, I mean, he's a piece of work. So he gets caught. He's convicted in 1986 for the murder of a 16-year-old boy.
Yeah.
And this is Danny Bridges, was the 16-year-old boy. And the way that they found Danny Bridges is in August of 1984, there's an apartment complex janitor. He's taking out all the trash from the apartment complex that day. He takes it out to the dumpster. He's getting ready to throw all the trash into the dumpster, and he realizes it's overflowing. Well, there had been a problem with people coming into the area and dumping their trash into the dumpster.
Yeah.
So the company that comes and picks up the trash that day or early the next morning, they're not going to pick up all this extra trash. So this is an ongoing problem that the janitor is dealing with. Now, this is not an expensive area of town. This is not a well-to-do area of a town. These are kind of lower level apartments. And the first observation that the janitor makes is that he sees several bags. There's 8 trash bags that appear to be a very good high quality trash bag. You know, like you can go to the trash bag aisle and there's the dirt cheap paper thin ones that just fall apart when you look at them. And then there's the other ones that you couldn't stretch them out and punch a hole in them. And he finds 8 very expensive gray trash bags. Well, he wants to know who's dumping the trash in his dumpster. So he gets these trash bags and pulls them out of the dumpster. He opens up one of them to see what's in it. And it's pieces of Danny Bridges. Larry Eiler lived in the apartment complex that was directly next to the apartment complex where they found the body of Danny Bridges. Now, the day before, multiple people were able to come forward after they found this body.
Uh-huh.
And they came forward to police and said, "We saw this man that lives in this apartment complex walking those bags over and throwing them into the dumpster."
Yeah, because they're gray bags, so they kind of stick out.
Exactly. And, you know, he's a white guy, and he might have looked pretty normal at the time, but I feel like he kind of stood out a little bit too, you know, like wearing the muscle shirts, and there's different pictures of him that you can see on the internet, and he just kind of stands out to me. Anyway, multiple people tell police that they had seen him carrying those bags and disposing of them in the dumpster. Well, this isn't too hard for the police to believe, because they had already suspected Eiler of being involved with crimes against young boys. Mm-hmm. Now, what did Eiler do? He was somebody that had been picked up by police more than one time. And on one of those occasions, he was spotted getting out of his pickup truck. So a police car pulls up. This is kind of out in the middle of the country somewhere. It was in a different state, I believe. This took place in Indiana. The police car pulls up. The truck is abandoned. He thinks it's abandoned. Uh-huh. But what he sees is two men walking into the woods. He goes up and he talks to him. Hey, you can't leave your truck here. Why are you going into the woods? What's going on? Well, one of the men is Larry Eiler. The other man he's handcuffed, or his arms are tied.
Right.
And he's pretty beaten up and he's pretty shooken up. He was going to, we can assume from other things that Eiler is suspected of, he was probably going to walk that young man into the woods and do horrible things to him until the young man died. Now, in his car, in the truck, they found a knife, a big knife. They found rope. They found tape, duct tape. They found handcuffs. Larry Eiler was basically driving around with a murder kit. And what they suspect that he would do is that he would pick up hitchhikers and male prostitutes, and he would take them out in the middle of nowhere. His best day, some people that knew him had said that his best day for Larry Eiler would be picking up a young man, taking him to a barn in the middle of nowhere, and doing whatever he wanted to him, whether it be sexual, torturing him, dismemberment, all kinds of stuff.
All kinds of abuse.
And he was horrible, horrible guy. And he could overpower some of these guys, too. And some of these male prostitutes were 15, 16-year-old boys that came from troubled areas that sold themselves on the streets.
Yeah, I think he had a lot of issues with homosexuality and his feelings or his sexual urges. I think he went back and forth between,
am I gay or am I not gay?
Or no, where I think he was sometimes repulsed by his own urges. So sometimes he was okay with that.
Because he did admittedly have some homosexual relationships that lasted of some length.
So I think it was just constantly battle. And look, it's early 80s. I mean, so this is not as common as it is today.
Now, he is convicted of multiple crimes, but he is ultimately sentenced to death in 1986 for the murder of Danny Bridges. Now, while on death row, he has AIDS. Larry Eiler had AIDS, and he passed away in 1994 of the AIDS virus. Mm. Now, police suspect that he killed at least 22 people. Now, why do they believe that? He started admitting to multiple murders. He started saying, you know, I've killed this person in this state and this person in this state. Kind of like what we saw with Henry Lee Lucas. However, this guy, the MO was the same every time. It was a young man found out in the middle of nowhere. It was a prostitute or a hitchhiker.
Well, and basically the way it worked was he would pick somebody up in a heavily populated area. And when he dumped the body, he was dumping it in a rural area.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know that they ever linked him to any crimes in Ohio or any abductions or murders in Ohio, but they strongly suspected that he had killed people in the states of Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, and possibly Ohio. Now, how did he become a suspect? Well, think about this. Danny Bridges, the victim, was disposed of in a very similar manner as Tony Muncy.
Right.
So as soon as Lavery discovers this serial killer, a potential serial killer, he announces that he is going to go to Chicago and he is going to interview this serial killer, potential serial killer. Now, one thing that they said about Eiler was that he, on occasion, that he knew the crimes, but he didn't always know the victims. So some of his victims, he was not able to provide a name for, but he was able to provide locations and what he had done to the bodies.
Yeah.
Now, he never admits to anything or being involved in the demise of Tony Muncy. And furthermore, the sheriff would go on to say that we can find no evidence to link Eiler to Columbus, Ohio. That we can't determine that he was in the area at the time.
He was originally from Indiana, and then he moves to Chicago, so he's heading west. But he has crimes that happen further east inside Indiana, so it's not that far-fetched to think. And then when you go down, now Kentucky's more south, yep. But it's not that far to think that from some of his crimes, the middle of Indiana, you're looking at about three and a half hour drive.
Yeah, and they think that his crimes carried him as far east as north central Kentucky. Eiler went about these confessions because he was trying to get his death sentence commuted to a life. He, you know, I will give you something that you need in trade for something that I need.
Which is motivation for not ever saying anything about the Tony Muncy case, because
you could hold on to that for later. Yeah. Or yeah, you could be tried for the death penalty
in Ohio. Yeah. So that's why I would say he would never confess to it anyways.
Unless he's going to say that I want a life sentence for the death of Tony Muncy in exchange for confession.
Yeah. I mean, his MO, the way he finds his victims and what kind of area, and then where he dumps the victims, mm-hmm. It's in a rural area. The other issue too is that he was known for picking up hitchhikers or people on the street or possible bus stations, we don't know, which again would fall in line with the Tony thing. The problem is, how do you get somebody that is mainly known for stuff in Indiana, Illinois, how do you put him in Ohio?
And the sheriff admittedly, especially after flying out there to interview Eiler, he admittedly said later that, you know what, we can't find anything tying him to Columbus, Ohio. We have no evidence that he was even in the area.
I think what he's hoping for is he's going to go out there and somehow get some information out of him.
Of course.
You know.
That either he was going to get a confession and find the murderer, or he was going to learn of this behavior, learn of some information that might help him find the person that did this.
He's still my number one suspect in this case.
I like him a little more than the other two suspects, because as said, I think you and I both agree that had Wickline Jr. done this, that we would have never found Tony's body.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense too, just with the age range.
Yeah.
Also with the interstate serial killer, I mean, it fits his age range as well. I mean, most of the time it was victims in their 20s, but sometimes it was
as early as 16. Well, yeah, the one guy that he was convicted of, Danny Bridges, was 16 years old.
Exactly. So that, I believe that is a bigger connection than the other two by far.
The other thing here too that I want to discuss is Timothy Hall. Now, do we have any reason to believe that Timothy Hall had a vehicle or access to a vehicle? Because whomever killed Tony Muncy had a vehicle or had access to it. The police clearly saw the skid marks on the side of the road. They know that, you know, every officer that was up at the scene said that this was a good spot to dump a body, and you could clearly tell that somebody slammed on their brakes, found this spot, and disposed of the body alongside the road, 10 to 15 feet from roadside. Now, Tony Muncy weighed about 110 pounds.
Right. I think it also has to come down to somebody that is pushing some weight.
Exactly. Because if not, then it needs to be two people, right? Two or more.
Yeah. And I don't believe it was.
No, I think that whoever got away with this or has remained, because this has remained unsolved, I believe that it was probably one person that could be dead, could be serving time for another crime, and it was a single person, because typically when multiple people are involved in something like this, people have a tendency to spill the beans. Sometimes people get drunk and they tell somebody something, or sometimes they tell a lover something that they did, or, you know, there's none of that has come out.
Yeah, I think it was a singular person, and like I said, I think their biggest motivation for never coming forward with the fact that they did it, if they were caught for any other crime, is the death penalty. And I also think this is a case that will never be solved.
I think that it's very unfortunate, but yes, I agree. I don't think that it will be solved. I think that I really believe, you know, if you had to pick somebody out of these three people, I agree with you, Captain. I would probably pick Eiler out of the three.
Yeah.
But more so, I probably like somebody that was more on Tony's inner circle. I really feel like this was somebody that probably knew him. There seemed to be a good amount of overkill involved here. And I wonder what...
I don't think this person knew him at all.
I think, you know, what is the motivation? It's hard to find the motive here. It's hard to find what the motivation was. He wasn't sexually assaulted. If he was robbed, he wasn't robbed of any good amount of money. Was somebody jealous of his girlfriend? Did somebody want to be with his girlfriend? Was this somebody from his school?
No.
No?
No. Find me a 15-year-old kid that commits this crime and then never, that does such a heinous crime, and then on top of that, never does another crime after that.
I think if it was somebody from the school, I think it was somebody that was a little older than Tony. I think it was somebody that had
make any sense to me.
Access to a vehicle, or it was an adult that lived in the area.
No, I think it's somebody that lived in Illinois or Indiana. That's what I believe. I believe it's the interstate killer, and that's...
You believe it was Larry Eiler?
Correct.
All right, well, we will have to agree to disagree. But we both agree that this was a very special episode. We want to thank everybody.
Probably our most gruesome, disturbing episode, and I'm going to need at least a week off or so.
Yes, we've been in the garage all day long, putting in the time, putting in the hours, putting together the episode.
Again, this goes a long way to supporting the free show that we put out every week. And so thank you guys so, so much.
Thank you for joining us in the garage. Tell your friends about the bonus episode. Tell your other friends to come and listen to the show. Go to truecrimegarage.com. Until next time, don't litter.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.